Welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back, folks. Thanks for joining me for another week. This week, I'd like to focus on three things: how to squash self-doubt, how to build self-confidence, and how to optimize on stress and pressure. Now, each of these three elements, they're constantly with us at work and sometimes at home. And how we balance that, how we are consciously playing with self-doubt, self-confidence, and pressure, well, that makes all the difference as to how we show up, how we deal with the challenges and the uncertainties in our life. And so I could speak volumes on this, but I thought I'd go directly to the source. And so I've invited a guest who's written volumes, literally volumes, on these subjects. His name is Ian Robertson. Ian is a professor emeritus at Psychology of Trinity College and was the founding director of Trinity College Institute of Neuroscience. Now, Ian is also the co-director of the Global Brain Health Institute, a member of the Royal Irish Academy, and a member of the Academia Europea. Ian is also a highly cited researcher on the brain's attentional systems. Now, Ian's wrote a number of popular science books, but two that really stood out to me and two that I just devoured was the first was The Stress Test, How Pressure Can Make You Stronger and Sharper. And his second book, well, that deals with confidence, How Confidence Works, The New Science of Self-Belief, Why Some People Learn and Others Don't. And so this next hour is just filled with insights and skills, and he shares his knowledge and experience about self-confidence and dealing with pressure. And I think all of us could be better at doing this. Well, I hope, dear listener, that you get as much out of this interview as that I did. So let's slip into the stream and meet Ian Robertson. Hello, Ian. Thank you for joining me on It's an Inside Job. I've been wanting to have this chat with you for the longest time. It's been a little back and forth trying to find an hour where both of our calendars sync, but here we are. We found that time. You know, I came across your book. I was in Milan on a long weekend with a good Irish friend, and I came across your book, The Stress Test, in an English bookstore in the Milan train station. And it kind of stood out to me, and I literally finished the book within 3 or 4 days. There was so much to learn from it. And then I discovered you had your second book, How Confidence Works. And for me, they were a part one and part two. You know, I'm someone who speaks a lot to these points on this podcast and in my coaching practice, but I found that your book added so much more dimension and vibrancy to my understanding, and I wanted to have this conversation with you for the longest time. So thank you for being on the show. I just wanted to kind of
thank you for these kind words. Thank you.
I was wondering, to begin with, if we could start the first part of the conversation on the stress test. What compelled you to write that book?
That's a great question. So I tell you what it was. Originally, the book was, I suggested the book be called The Sweet Spot.
Okay.
And the idea there was that I study the brain's attention systems. And for many years, I was trying to measure people's ability to sustain attention. To cut a long story short, I discovered that one of the chemical messengers in the brain, noradrenaline, or norepinephrine as it's known in the States, was critically important in this control of attention. But measuring this attention was very difficult because of the upside-down U-shaped function that noradrenaline's action has in the brain, which is also true of certain other of the chemical messengers like dopamine as well. But what happens is too little of this noradrenaline, like when you're very sleepy, you underperform, and too much, and you underperform. And there's this optimal sweet spot of noradrenaline. And I began to realize that a lot of what was happening when people were feeling stressed was they were, because noradrenaline is part of the fight or flight system, they were producing too much of this stuff. And that was interfering with their ability to think clearly and to solve the problems that were stressing them. And what's more, in a culture where we tend to medicalize our emotional conditions, people were kind of frightened of their anxiety. So there was fear of fear. And that made the noradrenaline levels even higher. So you get this negative cycle. So it was actually started off in my my study of attention, because I do think attention is critical to stress, and to because basically stress arises from a perception that the demands made on you exceed your ability to cope with them. A perception that consists of thoughts and images, and thoughts and images are changeable and replaceable, and you can learn and learnable. And so it should be possible, if people properly understand what's going on in their brains and their bodies, to actually learn to navigate it, and even better, to use that stress. And so I guess the theme of the book was stress is something, is the perception, that the energy that comes from that perception can actually be harnessed for good. And great sportsmen like and women, Tiger Woods said, "The day I'm not nervous when I go into the course is the day I give up." And
That's a great quote.
All great sportsmen and women are masters of their own minds. They understand how to harness this stuff that many people call stress or anxiety.
I think the word stress in itself has taken on a negative connotation. But what I hear you speaking to, Ian, is that stress, depending upon how we see it, well, we have two other English words. I'm based in Norway, so just to sort of parse the English here, is that you have distress, which is more of a negative form of stress, and then you have eustress, which you speak about, where Tiger Woods takes that stress and uses it to optimize his performance or his thinking, his mindset. Is that what I understand you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, the thing is, you know, I was once at home in a Saturday afternoon, and suddenly my heart started to pound, and my skin was sweaty, and my mouth was dry, and my stomach was tight. So if I asked someone what emotion I was having, they'd probably say anxiety or fear. And I'd say, no. Scotland had just beat England at rugby. So I say to you, well, how come one emotion, it's so different, excitement, can have exactly the same symptoms as another emotion, anxiety? And the answer is that these are simply symptoms of arousal of the body and brain preparing for action. And it doesn't care what that action is, whether it's running away or celebrating. And so it only becomes a particular emotion by the words we put on that, by the context. And we have the power to change these words and to change that context.
I think that was remarkable, because what I hear you saying is that whether it's anxiety or whether it's excitement, how we define it, they have the same physiological markers. But what tells the difference is the narrative, the story we're telling ourselves about the context. And we have the power to shift or redefine the meaning we're giving to the situation, to reattribute it to something more positive or constructive for yourself. Is that what I understand you're saying, Ian?
Yes, precisely. And there's another emotion that has very similar profile, and that is anger. And there's a lot of anger about these days. And, you know, I think it was Socrates said, you know, anger is a very dangerous emotion. So some people say it burns the vessel clean. It's a cleansing emotion. Mark Twain said it does more damage to the vessel holding it. And so who's right? Well, Socrates suggested that anger is great, but it has to be directed at a specific person or group with a specific request of that group. And so that you know what you're angry about, and you know, because anger is essentially a negotiation tool. So non-specific anger, feeling angry about injustice generally or about what your life's course generally, is a very dangerous emotion because the symptoms are identical to those of anxiety. So what you're doing is you're doubling your distress. When you're angry, you're anxious. And simultaneously, when you're anxious, you're angry. And the evidence is that people have been in accidents, their traumatic stress gets worse over time if they feel angry in a non-untargeted way about the cause of their injury.
And that's one of the interesting things I found in the book. Again, the book that I bought is dog-eared and underlined. One of the things is you described that you articulate anger in versus anger out, where anger in is where we kind of suppress and hold it in, and anger out is directed. Could you explain the difference, how one is healthier than the other?
So anger is an energizing emotion. Mm-hmm. So whereas anxiety tends to make you pull back and avoid, anger is designed to help you take action to change a situation. But essentially, anger is an interpersonal tool to strengthen your hand in negotiation. So if you look at two dogs, dogs growl at each other, and they growl much more than they ever fight. Mm. And it's the one that growls the deepest and the hardest that generally results in the other dog slinking off, tail between his leg. Well, anger is a bit like that. It's a negotiation tool between people. But if you feel that the world is unfair or that your lot in life is unfair, that sense of injustice tends to make you feel angry. But that is an impotent anger, because you don't have a particular person or group of people of whom you're making a specific demand to do X or Y or not do X or Y. So if you can channel anger in that way, so to a specific movement or a specific set of actions, then it is something that kind of makes you feel very good because it has energized you to take action. So the critical thing here is action. It is very difficult to know what action to take if the anger is general and non-specific. Mm-hmm. And then so you feel angry. What happens then? It all gets, because the emotions only exist as a context we place on them, you don't know whether you're feeling angry or anxious. And that doubles the length of time, even more than doubles the length of time when you're feeling in an unpleasant state. Whereas if you know that I want that neighbor not to be using his leaf blower
at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
9 o'clock, yeah. You have a specific action. And the question is not to make that request in an angry way, but in an instrumental way that's going to get the goal that you want achieved.
Direct and diplomatic. That's what I hear you're saying. Because I think that's really interesting what you're saying, where anger in is kind of, it's intangible, it's abstract, it just floats around, where anger out is directed action towards something where I take a sense of control and certainty. I'm dealing with the situation. And that can move me from distress to eustress, as I understand, or positive stress.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, eustress is a nice concept, but stress. Mm. Yes, stress is a perception. The emotion, underlying physiology is a general arousal and preparation for action, and that action can be avoiding and pulling back, attacking or celebrating, and it's a question of realizing that you have the capacity to relabel that arousal in a positive way or a negative way or a neutral way indeed. Mm-hmm.
And what I found also very interesting with your book is how you talked about the differentiation between the hemispheres. Because what also resonated with me, Ian, I don't know if you're familiar with another neuroscientist, Jill Bolte Taylor. She wrote a book where her left hemisphere was completely knocked out. And when I read that...
Brilliant book.
Yeah, yes. And I read a lot of connections. And so as I understood from what you've articulated in your book, the left hemisphere is about approach, where the neurons or the brain cells are wired in that hemisphere for approach. It's about taking action. It's goal-oriented. But it's also the ability for it to parse and see the difference between things, the ability to categorize and to prioritize, where the right... as I understand it, is more towards avoidance. Now, avoidance is not always a negative thing to withdraw or to shrink back. But as you said, it's also about self-awareness. It's about creativity. It's about self-reflection. And so you have the left and the right. And as I understand from your book, is when we are in a distress or negative stress, or we've given the arousal into a negative, given it a negative connotation, that we withdraw, and that draws up anxiety or anger or frustration, whatever it is. Is it also because there's an imbalance in the hemispheres, and part of finding being more reflected is to equally activate those hemispheres, so you have the right and the left, you know? I'm stretching it.
Yes,
is that what I understand?
No, there is evidence to support that, Jason. That because the two hemispheres are in competition with each other, so they're mutually inhibitory. And in a healthy state, the evidence is that most of us are slightly more inclined to the approach system. So there's a slight imbalance, particularly in men, in favor of approach, which leads to a certain overconfidence, a likelihood to take action, and a slight rosy over-optimism. You know, that's the source of all the vast profits of the online gambling industry. But, you know, but it's a kind of health, it's not an unhealthy, it's a kind of healthy slight imbalance, but there's still the right hemisphere, particularly the right frontal lobe, is still capable of self-monitoring. It's still capable of empathy. It's still capable of perceiving risk. So it's only a slight imbalance. But if a person becomes hooked on an appetitive stimulus like power or money or sex or cocaine, then you get, or gambling, you know, you get this increasing dominance of the left hemisphere approach systems, which tends to inhibit the right hemisphere empathic self-awareness risk sensitive systems of the brain, and that leads to all sorts of disasters. And vice versa, if someone's got stuck in an avoidant mode, painful self awareness, everyone's looking at me, painful exaggeration of the bad things that are going to happen in the future, memory system biased towards remembering past failures, difficult even to remember past successes, they don't come to mind, painfully aware of the one person frowning at them, ignoring the 100 people that are either smiling at them or not paying any attention to them. So this whole biasing of the system that causes this retreat, and that, of course, inhibits the left hemisphere approach system, so that person becomes paralyzed. It becomes a huge challenge to take any action, to do anything, because of all the anticipated negative consequences.
In the second part of our conversation, we shift the conversation from dealing with stress and pressure to that of how to build confidence. Because the more confidence we have, the better we are at dealing with pressure and stress. In part two, Ian breaks down confidence into two self-beliefs, can do and can happen. Can do means that I can do something about it. And then there's can happen, that I believe that there will be a positive outcome to my efforts. But depending upon this, depending upon the can do and can happen self-belief, it can either lead to apathy, anger, anxiety, or action. And so he takes apart the DNA of confidence and explains how we can shift this, and how if we adopt an implemental mindset, that means we take action and we focus on things that we control and certainty. If, on the other hand, he speaks to the deliberative mindset, where that opens us up to self-doubt. Well, I'll let Ian explain the rest of this. Okay, let's take it away. Because one of the things that really resonated with me, you said, is one way of dealing with stress, or shifting from, translating from anger in to anger out, is to find something tangible, something that we can invest our effort and action towards. So if I ask questions, for example, towards a client who's feeling more distress, negative stress, and I orient and engineer those questions towards certainty, control, or some sort of predictable outcome or actions they can take towards that outcome, can that help shift this arousal system to something more constructive?
Yes, it can, very much so. In fact, people talk a lot about CBT and cognitive behavior therapy, mm-hmm. but the behavior tends to be neglected in the cognitive behavior therapy. I trained in the Institute of Psychiatry in London, which was a very behaviorist place at the time, and the cognitive came later, and it was a great addition. But, you know, it's not just a question of encouraging me to do something. Mm-hmm. It's about helping me tangibly plan a feasible sub-goal that will take me a little bit out of my discomfort zone, stretch me a little bit. But you see, goals have the sweet spots as well. Too easy, it doesn't cut the mustard because you don't get the success experience. Too difficult, and you're increasing the chances of failure experiences. So you have this sweet spot for goals. And the successful people, and I mean emotionally successful people, are usually masters and mistresses of structuring their life and setting goals in such a way to produce mini success experiences. And mini success experiences are natural mini antidepressants and natural mini anti-anxiety drugs, because of their effects on the dopamine system of the brain. And so in terms of regaining this balance, particularly of the domination of anxiety and avoidance, the behavior is critical, the taking the action in spite of the anxiety, of realizing that the fact that you're anxious is irrelevant to whether or not you take this action. And it's about properly crediting yourself with the goal achieved, because too often, particularly perfectionist people, will, the moment they've achieved a goal, they will negate it because compared to some greater goal, it appears trivial. So they have to learn cognitive skills of giving themselves full credit. And of course, we'll be talking about confidence later, but confidence, one of the great sources of confidence is doing stuff in spite of adversity, including the adversity of anxiety. So taking action in spite of anxiety is a great way of learning to master that anxiety and build your confidence to be able to do more stuff.
And I think that's well articulated. You know, when I'm working with people, they're mostly corporate clients now and such, and they're, let's say it's presentation anxiety or what have, they have to speak in front of the board or, you know, the executive team. A lot of people have, you know, it could be 6 weeks and we're talking about theoretically, yeah, I can do it. I'll push through my anxiety. But as we come closer and closer to the date, there seems to be almost this, in what seems to be a little wall of anxiety. It increases and grows as they approach it, it becomes this monumental wall in front of them. But what, you know, they could just walk through that wall. It's just an invisible wall. And on the other side is what I hear you saying is, once they've mastered the challenge, that can infuse their confidence. I was wondering, how do you get someone to embrace the struggle, to face adversity when they are facing anxiety? Because one thing is to talk about it and logically they understand it, but it's another thing for them to emotionally align with that logic. And sometimes that emotion is what rules their behavior. How do you encourage, through your practice or working for so many years with people such as this, to face adversity, to challenge their anxiety? Because it's just that invisible wall. It can't hurt them.
Through intermediate goals. So I wouldn't leave it until the big wall appears.
Okay. Yeah.
One of my sessions would be them presenting mm-hmm. to me. I would try and build as create the circumstances increasingly realistic mm-hmm. to the event. So by the time they come to the big wall, they have actually done most of the behaviors that will be required of them. And that, so that's, so another factor here is
yes.
the goals. So for instance, you arrange for a practice session mm-hmm. in front of maybe a few friends, or maybe, in front of a simulated audience, maybe just in front of you initially.
Sure.
And then you get them to do the presentation. But then what you do is you say, okay, your goal is, one of your goals actually is an internal goal, mm-hmm. which is to do this in spite of your anxiety. It doesn't matter how well you do it. It doesn't matter. It's the fact that you have done it in spite of your anxiety. So it's like someone who's maybe prone to temper outbursts or difficulty responding to mm-hmm. provocation or aggression. You can set someone the external goal of speaking coolly and professionally in the face of provocation, but before that, you can also set them the internal goal of mastering their own responses to that situation, irrespective of how good or bad these responses are. So it's a question of, again, goal setting and realizing that you can become master of your own arousal by getting satisfaction from, for instance, having performed X in spite of that arousal.
And I think that whole sense of role playing, or in a sense, picking the low hanging fruit that is not threatening, that kind of slowly builds confidence. And I think what I understand from both of your books, how we face stress or face that arousal system in us, and how we define that as either something we can approach and tackle or we shy away from. Well, that leads us to your second book. It's the level of confidence. If we could just shift the conversation here just to bridge it, because this is into the part two. I think your definition of confidence was really good. You broke it down into two self-beliefs. I was wondering if you could just elaborate on self-confidence as you've defined it in your book.
Yeah. So confidence is not optimism. Optimism is the belief that things will turn out. It's not self-esteem. Self-esteem is a self-evaluation of your qualities in some dimension. The secret sauce of confidence is it's linked to action. So it's not a general thing. Self-confidence is self-confidence in a given domain. So you can be self-confident academically, but not self-confident socially, for example.
Yeah.
And there's two aspects to self-confidence. One, so it's a belief mm-hmm. that you can do something. So that, and it has two strands. Can do is the belief that you can actually execute that action. And the can happen, the belief that if you execute that action, then the desired outcome will happen. Mm-hmm. So I believe I can stop smoking. And I believe that if I do stop smoking, my health will improve. So that gives you that can do and can happen gives you four dimensions. You can mm-hmm. have can't do, can't happen. is apathy. And that can be visualized in the brain with lower dopamine activity, low mood, apathy. Mm-hmm. Can do, can't happen, leads to frustration, at least to anger. And that activates the noradrenaline system, the fight or flight system. I could stop smoking, but you know what? My father died of cancer anyway.
He stopped. Doesn't matter what I do, things are going to still turn out negative in a sense.
I could get that college degree, but you know what? From where I come from, it's not going to improve my my outcome. And then the bottom left, you have can't do, can happen. You know, I can't stop smoking. I know if I could, I'd be healthier, or I can't change my diet. And I know if I could, I'd lose weight. So that leads to anxiety. So that's also the noradrenaline system. And then you have the can do, can happen, which is the full whammy of confidence. And that's a self-fulfilling belief. Why? Because the brain treats the belief that you can do something and that there will be a good outcome as if the good outcome has happened. And you get a little surge of dopamine activity, and it's chalked up in the brain as a success experience. And that makes, that lifts your mood, it lowers your anxiety, and makes it more likely you will take the action in question. And you will also, because of the increased dopamine, it will, within limits, improve your cognitive functioning, your ability to deliver that action well, because of the synchronizing effects of dopamine in the frontal lobes. So it's a sweet combination of self-fulfilling prophecy that leads to the successful action and the successful outcome, which, of course, because of something called the winner effect, the greatest source of success is success. And so you get the wonderful
like compound interest.
Yeah, that's right. The exponential compound interest of confidence.
It's the way you articulated, you know, self-confidence. It's not just this ethereal feeling, but it's something concrete you can do. It's about shifting our beliefs, shifting the narratives of can do, that this can happen. And then as you've articulated in the book, it's a bridge to the future. And so self-confidence, linked back to your, to the first book, The Stress Test, it seems to be a very left hemisphere dominant, because you're goal-oriented. It's about wanting. It's about moving in a certain direction, having the confidence to do that. And so that triggers, obviously, the reward system, dopamine, you know, this anticipation that things will be better. Now, just to backtrack, dopamine is something that's mainly produced in the left hemisphere, and noradrenaline is something that's mainly produced in the right hemisphere. In very simple
terms. They're produced in the brainstem nuclei, but there's greater distribution. There's a slightly greater distribution of noradrenaline to the right hemisphere, and dopamine's effects are bilateral, but they particularly influence the left frontal cortex in when it comes to planning action. So what's called attentional set and anticipating a successful goal. And so, but the other thing about the two hemispheres and these two systems is the, what it does to attention.
So that's where I wanted to go.
What focus, being focused on a goal and being confident you can deliver on that goal, is it narrows your attention. Whereas what and anticipating risk and avoidance does is it broadens your attention. Now, when your attention is narrowed, say on an anticipated goal, that automatically lowers your anxiety, because there's no room for distressing thoughts or worrying thoughts. Because what... you know, your thoughts determine your emotions, and your thoughts are determined by your attention. So when you open your mind to possible risk, that increases the risk of anxiety, of thinking bad things might happen. So that's one of the great things about confidence, is that, and one of the, it's the critical therapeutic benefits of action, is when you're implementing something and taking action, by definition, your attention is focused, and that shields you from all the confidence sapping, self-doubting thoughts. Mm-hmm. And that's called the implementation mode. And women in particular benefit their relative lack of overconfidence compared to men is recompensated slightly when they're in an implementation mode. And that's why action is so important. But you can't be stuck in that mode all the time. Periodically, you have to review your goals. You have to review your strategy. You have to consider what the risks are. So you have to, but that's to do with controlling your attention, narrowing to goal, and then broadening out, what is my goal? That's called deliberation. And in that state, which is necessary, that's where confidence can be, you can begin to doubt your ability to deliver on the action because you're considering risks.
I think, it, as you said, you know, you've studied attention, and that's one of the main drivers for writing these books, because attention, as I understand it, it's one of the most valuable resources we have. We never run out of it, but we don't, sometimes it just goes on automatic and it kind of fixates on the negative or on the things that don't help us. And so what I hear you saying, Ian, is that, you know, in critical situations, when we need to find that confidence to deal with a stressful situation, is to be conscious or to be in the here and now with our attention and to deliberate where we focus. And maybe deliberate is not wrong, but maybe not deliberate, but to attend to where we focus, because you've talked about the implementation mindset and the deliberative mindset. And sometimes by focusing on what we can implement, what we can invest our actions and our efforts, that keeps us on what we can control and certainty. And slowly, as you said, that compound interest builds this confidence, as I understand it, because it's very tangible the way you've explained it. It's not just this sort of soft, abstract things. No, these are questions. I mean, these are specific things that we can do to build our confidence. Focus on what you can control. Focus on how you can build certainty, maybe on your prior knowledge or prior experience, to bring that to the forefront to deal with the situation and to talk about specific actions. In the final part of our conversation, Ian talks about the attentional system. Now, this is his area of expertise. He connects attention to confidence. And how we cognizantly invest our attention, that will shift our confidence, how we show up to the game, how we engage with the world or the challenge or the uncertainty in front of us. So Ian shares with us a number of skills that he uses, concrete, tangible skills to build confidence, to deal with stress, to deal with pressure, and to deal with uncertainty, to lead ourselves and to lead others. So I hope you enjoy this final part. Take it away, Ian.
Personally, I don't do very much individual therapy anymore. I did many years ago. I'm very much aware of people needing to understand their own minds and brains better. So, for example, you know, and understanding how they need to, understanding it offline, talking with you or me, is different from understanding it online in the situation. So for example, so you can say to them, look, in this presentation you have to give, you have to be aware that your attention, if you're anxious, your attention will be biased. It will be biased towards looking for signals of threat. The person frowning, shaking their head or looking at their phone rather than listening to you. And even if there's only one person in the room doing that, your attention will focus on that person, and that will therefore exaggerate the frequency of that behavior and the implications of it. So you, person can understand that offline, but having the mental space to do that online in the situation in question requires that you have practiced that many times. If nothing else in your mind, maybe even, you know, in simulated presentations, you have to develop the mental habit or metacognitive habit of thinking about your thinking or attending to your attention. You have to practice doing that. And that's, of course, what high-performance sports people, pilots,
simulations and visualization pilots, techniques and such.
They have to do all the, they have to know they understand their own minds. They understand where their attention is, and they can avoid some of the pitfalls. So from my point of view, it's a combination of an educational effort. But the abstract knowledge is not enough. It has to be then implemented and practiced in simulated situations. And I mean, the one of the best simulated situations is the mind's eye. An incredible amount of work can be done in rehearsing, in actually, and all great sports performers are masters and mistresses of simulating their actual sports performance sitting in their armchair. They can simulate, and how well they can simulate it in terms of timing is highly correlated with their actual performance in real life.
I think that's a very salient point you've made because, you know, as I understand it, habits, whether mental or physical, use the same networks. They use the same sort of infrastructure in our head to build that. And so, you know, physically, I might write quite adept with my right hand, and I'm like a child with my left. But if I practice enough with my left hand over time, I will become also adept. And I think what you're saying is we have one way of thinking, but if we start thinking or focusing in another way over time, whether through visualization, through the mind's eye, through practice, through conversation, that we also develop another habit, and that could become our default habit. Is that what I understand you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And the greatest obstacle to that is having a, what Carl Dweck was famously called, a fixed mindset about your emotions or about your abilities, a kind of fatalism, a lack of faith in your ability to learn or relearn, and feeling trapped by the negative habit that you don't want. And the trouble with that fixed mindset of saying, oh, really, that as my mother was like this, I am just like this. Trouble with that fatalism, we know that learning is slow and up and down. It takes 60 or 70 repetitions of even a simple single behavioral response, like eating a piece of fruit every day. It takes 60 or 70 times doing that before it becomes automatic and effortless, that you don't have to think about it. Well, imagine how many more repetitions you require of a lifetime ingrained cognitive or emotional habit. It takes thousands of repetitions. And in many of these practices, some days it will feel you're back to square one. And that's when the fatalism kicks in, saying, ah, what's the point? You know, I can't do this. So you have to have a number of meta beliefs about realizing, yeah, okay. You've got to record you've got to have some sense of progress, you know, so you have to gauge your goals very, very carefully and finely. And some of these goals are internal, some of them are external.
And I think sometimes, you know, when people pick up books like yourself, that can be a sense of encouragement because it's very nuts and bolts. It's talking about the neurobiology of how we are. And just understanding is that, you know what, my brain is an organ like my heart. My heart pumps blood. My brain pumps survival. But I can use this mind to step back and I can re-engineer the story I'm telling myself to move from whatever anxiety to excitement, or from anger in to anger out. From dealing with the abstract to more tangible, concrete things to slowly build my confidence. And so what I hear you saying, Ian, is between fixed and growth mindset, fixed is a sense of belief that this is the way I was born, this is the way I'm raised, I can't change, everything is getting fixed. And it's like, no. And back to what you were talking about, CBT, cognitive behavioral, sometimes we can't use the brain to get out of the brain, but sometimes we can do behaviors. We can try to execute on an action, and executing on that action brings a new experience. And then that experience can actually add more color or vibrancy to our very gray or negative beliefs. It's like, oh, I can actually do that. And so again, this comes back to, I love your book, The Can Do and Can Happen. If you can show them through behavior they can do, well, that's that can be a low-hanging fruit, but that's an early win. And as you said so saliently, is that if I compound these small little actions, slowly my confidence can build. And so does this suggest that we can move from a fixed mindset, even though that's a belief we believe for ages, to a growth mindset?
Yeah, I mean, the evidence is quite strong that you can actually change people's fixed growth mindset. Mm. Not to, I mean, it's been done with big studies in the States with particularly kids from, you know, lower socioeconomic backgrounds, mm-hmm. who maybe feel stereotyped and, you know, and stigmatized. Yeah. And by just explaining to them the basic neuroscience of the brain's plasticity, how nothing is set in stone, and it's all up for a huge amount is up for grabs, mm-hmm. and that but it's a self-fulfilling prophecy if you believe that your abilities are fixed and not changeable, mm-hmm. and sometimes, but then you need the tangible evidence of that. But that's a critical obstacle to critical kind of building block to put in place is the high the metacognitive belief that change is possible. Without that, then people give up at the first setback and lose faith in the arduous business of relearning and changing habits.
You know, and back to the idea, you know, people can pick up books like yours and that will give them that sense of empowerment that they are not just their brains, that they have this ability to step back, become the bystander, the observer, and to change things. And what you speak of, neuroplasticity, just for those who don't know, is that the brain will actually morph and change and evolve based upon our dominant way of thinking. So if we shift our thinking over time and we try to be conscious of what as you said, where we place our attention, we can literally re-engineer our brains to a specific, certain level. I was wondering, you are sort of, you know, very adept and skilled and knowledgeable in this area, but I guess you're human. You are part of the human condition, and sometimes you hit a wall. You hit a place of frustration or anxiety. May I ask, what do you specifically do to when you're kind of going down to the valley to get yourself back up on the hill to move forward when you feel yourself withdrawing or retracting from whatever situation?
Yeah. There's some very simple habits. I do a regular, mindfulness app, which many people do, which I find incredibly helpful. I'll often, if I wake up in the morning, say anxious about something, I'll often consciously smile.
That's a good thing.
just deliberately smile. And, yeah. because I will also, because these are, there's 100 little habits to do with confidence. And they're habits of emotional expression, but also habits of posture, of just standing tall. Obviously, physical exercise, going for a, go for a run or go for a swim. You can change your brain chemistry hugely that way. Just set a task. Tidy that drawer, whatever it is, do something that you get a sense of, well, I've done that. Reward yourself. So reward myself. If I do that, I'm going to have a nice cream bun or whatever it is. and they're all so simple. Not allowing myself to say self-deprecating things like, this is probably rubbish, but, just say it in the meeting, speak it out in the meeting. I think that. And not try and ward off potential criticism by self-deprecation. Mm. Habits of reassurance. And just realizing that actually it's critical to all of this is setting goals that stretch you a bit where you get a mini sense of achievement. And these goals can be in any domain of life.
You've shared a lot of skills. You've shared a lot of knowledge today. And I think when you said, not talk self-deprecating, sort of negative mind talk or negative self-talk to ourselves. And I think part of it understanding is that sometimes a lot of people have these emotions. They'll categorize as negative and positive. But what I like to tell people is that we have this spectrum of emotions. They're not negative or positive, but every emotion serves as a function. It's a signal, a chemical messenger from our physiology to our psychology that something's going on, Jason, deal with it. And as what you were saying, and it was so salient in your book that sometimes our brains misread those signals instead of No, it's not anxiety. It's actually kind of excitement because you're watching a football game right now, for example. That sometimes what I try to do in my practice is to tell people, look, whatever emotion you're feeling, it's okay, but notice the emotion. Don't say, I am angry or I am frustrated, but I notice I am. And that allows you to kind of step back from what you're saying when it comes to shifting to a growth mindset. So we don't feel, oh, here I go again, I'm frustrated, it's just me. No.
So that not identifying with your emotions, realizing you're neither your emotions nor are you your thoughts. And the human brain in its complexity has this capacity to watch itself watching and think about itself thinking and think about itself feeling. Mm-hmm. And that the moment you adopt that slightly detached version, it can take the sting out of that rage you feel at the person who's just offended you. If you kind of manage to mentally step back a little bit and watch yourself being so enraged, it suddenly can lose its power. Some people do a kind of running commentary on themselves, a third person description. Oh, there you go. Oh, there he goes. There he is. He's getting all, oh, feel these pulses.
You know, excited.
Yeah. And that sometimes that kind of commentator role in your head can be one way of getting.
That's really good advice. Yeah. I mean, you can almost say, oh, there goes Jason again. He's going all limbic. He's going all, mushroom cut over his head, right?
Yeah.
And that gives you perspective. That's a very good technique.
Yeah.
Well, Ian, it's coming close to the hour. I really appreciate your time. I was wondering, was there any last advice? We covered a lot, so maybe there isn't, but is there any last advice or suggestion you could give to our audience when it comes to dealing with stress in a constructive way and maybe building confidence?
Values. Get
values.
Values. And our self-esteem rests on our values. Mm-hmm. Basically, we all try to feel good about ourselves. Even criminals in prison rate themselves as morally, on average, better than people who are not in prison. And so we all have this struggle to maintain a good image of ourselves, and that basically boils down to our values. And affirming our values and kind of taking time to say, well, what are my values? What is it I stand for? And it could be family, it could be integrity, it could be persistence, it could be ambition.
Contribution. It could be any number.
It could be 100. And it's just bringing your values to mind can be a huge antidote to confidence undermining anxious thoughts or criticisms or self criticism from other people, because values are eternal. Values aren't, unlike us, aren't transitory candles of consciousness in the universe. Values will exist after we have died. And so there's a certain grounding of self-esteem, which can really, although self-esteem is not confidence, if you feel secure in your valuation of yourself, you'll be less defensive about criticism, more inclined to do the right thing as you see it, as opposed to try and please someone or try and avoid, try and react to someone. Yeah. So that'd be my main tip.
Well, thank you very much for that, Ian. I really appreciate your time, and I know you're a busy man, so I appreciate the generosity that you've spent here with me today. So thanks for that.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, folks, that was Ian Robertson, Professor Emeritus in Psychology at Trinity College in Dublin, neuroscientist and author. And so the two books that we talked about today was The Stress Test, How Pressure Can Make You Stronger and Sharper, and his second one, How Confidence Works, The New Science of Self-Belief, Why Some People Learn It and Others Don't. So you'll be able to find the links in the show notes, as well as all of Ian's contact information. So again, Ian, thank you very much for the generosity of sharing your time, your knowledge, and your experience and your wisdom with us today. Well, folks, that brings us to an end of another episode.
As usual, if you can go on to whatever podcast platform you enjoy listening to this show on and rate, give me a score that you think is reflective of the quality and the content of this podcast. Also, if you wish to receive a weekly newsletter, it's just a short email that I send out every Wednesday morning. It will just update you on the upcoming episode, and I also share a weekly article with you that does a deeper dive into one of the subjects that we cover on this podcast. And you can find all that information in the show notes again. Anyways, folks, wow, another episode in the box, in the can. We are done. Well, until next week, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon. Thank you.